welcome to the B-Rad Podcast. It's Brad Kearns. These are our sponsors. Male Optimization Formula with Organs, Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece, Perfect Keto Ketone Supplements, Carol Fit Stationary Bike, Organifi Superfood, Viore Clothing, and Let's Get Check.com Home Testing. And please visit the BradKearns.com shop page for my personal selection of favorite products for health, fitness, and peak performance with great discount offers. And now here we go with the show, mofo.
We're the highest metabolic rate ape, which means if you control for body size, body composition, lifestyle, all of it, we're burning energy at about 20% more per day than chimpanzees and bonobos, which are the closest, our closest relatives. And yet, even though we have these high metabolic rates, we're also the fattest apes. And so what you think of as sort of your organs energy expenditure or your organ systems energy expenditure, you know, we can give these numbers like 300 calories a day for your brain or 300 calories a day for your liver, but that's the kind of at baseline. Now your brain doesn't go up and down very much, that's true, but the rest of your organ systems do. Lower inflammation is one of the big benefits of exercise. And there's other things you can do too that will help you, you know, minimize inflammation, but exercise is a big one. If I want a kid to reach his full height potential, then I can feed him super well and make sure he doesn't get sick and I can do all the right things. But I still can't make somebody whose parents are both 5'0", 7 feet tall. That's really unlikely. For all the evidence points to longevity being the same kind of thing.
Uh-oh, listeners, hold your hats, part two, because we are back with a vengeance, like a movie sequel. It is the one and only Dr. Herman Ponser, author of the transformative book called Burn, about energy expenditure in the human. And his mind-blowing insights cannot leave my brain. I never sleep fitfully. I always sleep like a rock. But when I wake up in the morning, let's say, I'm tormented, inspired, captivated, and continuing to obsess upon these topics that I learned in his book. So we had a wonderful initial full-length interview talking through the book concepts. But then I just blasted this poor guy who's trying to get work done in the highest levels of academia. Here comes this random podcast host and pushing him up against the wall. And I'm like, dude, we gotta get through this. And so we are going to dig deeper into this fascinating insight of the constrained model of energy expenditure. That is, that the average daily caloric expenditure of the human is constrained or does not change much regardless of our activity level. Yes, indeed, this blows the lid off the foundational premise of the fitness industry, not to mention the diet and weight loss industry. So please pay attention and listen carefully. This is one of the world's leaders. His area of expertise is calorie burning, energy expenditure, not just in humans and in other apes. And that's kind of the starting point for the discussion, where we have to envision ourselves here as Homo sapiens and the ins and outs of what we do all day, especially with brain function, kidney, heart, liver, the digestive system working behind the scenes, regardless of whether you exercise or not. And then when we do work out and we get into that fitness lifestyle, boy, it's not delivering the direct application to result that we think it is. And it's just so fascinating to realize the true reasons that exercise is so beneficial and important, especially relating to how it prevents or mitigates chronic inflammation, which is believed to be the root cause of all disease. But this is a hard-hitting show. Those the leaders in academia have to go toe-to-toe and stand behind their work, even if it conflicts with the widely held beliefs, especially us in the diet, weight loss, ancestral health scene have all embraced this model of carbohydrate consumption driving excess insulin production, driving obesity. And Herman was polite enough to say that these concepts are plausible, but it does not affect body composition, weight loss in the direct way that we've long assumed. And yes, indeed, this flies in the face of that ideas that were promoted by big-time leaders in this field like Gary Taubes and Dr. Jason Fung. So you get to think for yourself. Here's an alternative point of view. And boy, It's backed by a lot of research, so much so that I'm titling this show, quoting Herman from the first minute of the show, where he said, yep, the data always wins. Please enjoy Dr. Herman Ponser, a true leader and paradigm shifter, and his long research of the Hadza in Tanzania, along with the calorie expenditure by modern living humans all over the world for years and years. Fun stuff. Boom, here we go.
Herman.
Hey, Brad, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, except for we've been talking about you nonstop. I'm into it with Sisson and my other confidants, and our minds are getting blown.
Cool.
You're messing with the foundation of the fitness industry and the gimmicky diet industry with your life's work and validated research.
Good. I don't mind messing with those people. That's fine.
Yeah, I mean, you got to swing hard. I guess in academia too, you got to be legit, and you come and do a presentation, and maybe the other person at the conference has a different point of view, and it's like, come on now, this is high stakes.
I guess so, man. You know what I love about doing science is that the data wins. You know, we get to show. You know, that's what the peer reviewed literature is all about. As boring as it is. And nobody ever goes, you know, too much into it unless you're in the field. But that's kind of where, that's where the rubber hits the road, man.
You just titled the podcast, by the way. we started recording. We don't need any small talk with this guy. And the data wins. That reminds me. So you're in the field. Is that kind of rare? Like, is it 1 out of 10 people who are actually heading out into the wild lands of the planet to do their research? And then there's other people that are in ivory towers looking at your research, not to criticize it, but I'm saying your role is you have a certain contribution to science and to the academic community that you exist in. Are other people have a disparate role and a whole different scene?
Yeah. I mean, I think the ecosystem kind of gets divvied up by people who do more sort of lab or bench work and people who do more field work, out in the field. We try to do both, which I think is a strength of my research group. But yeah, certainly in the nutrition world, you know, there's plenty of people who have much larger budgets and much bigger groups to go and measure, you know, the particulars of any dietary intervention or any exercise intervention, right? And they can do these for 16 months, and they've got enormous labs full of people and postdocs and everybody, and they do those very well. And I've certainly, you know, integrated those insights and those data and everything, but they're not going to go out and live with a Hadza for a few months. So I guess that's what I bring to the table.
Oh man. Okay. So the listeners are going to be strongly encouraged to listen to our previous show about your wonderful book, Burn. But what's happened in the aftermath is I've been bombarding you with emails, hopefully thoughtful enough that you actually answered and agreed to come back on. But, you know, this insight, we need to take a deep breath here and realize the ramifications of it, as applied to the conventional model of the fitness industry and the diet industry. And so if we have this constrained amount of calorie burning, and there's a great graph. Did you make that graph, the constrained model versus the additive model?
All the stuff in that book is all the graphs and everything are mine. So, yep.
Yeah. So we have this idea that that calorie burning is constrained. And I think to help me understand, one of the insights that really hits home is when you compare us to the gorilla. And so, you know, we're Homo sapiens. We have different lifestyles. Some people ride the subway and sit in front of a screen and ride the subway back and watch Netflix. But we're all in the same species. Thereby, we're constrained first and foremost as humans, and then we're going to talk about lifestyle and diet and exercise.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, every species has its own like trajectory through time and space, you know, and we've ended up where we are. We have higher metabolic rates than other apes do. So the other apes are the, you know, chimps, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans. Orangutans are actually hypometabolic. They have low metabolic rates. They burn about half the calories we do for the same body size and activity level. We're higher than chimpanzees and bonobos. But, you know, it's interesting. We're the highest metabolic rate ape, which means if you control for body size, body composition, lifestyle, all of it, we're burning energy at about 20% more per day than chimpanzees and bonobos, which are the closest, our closest relatives. And yet, even though we have these high metabolic rates, we're also the fattest apes because, you know, paired with that high metabolic rate, right, has been selection for a bit of a reserve gas tank, right? Because, you know, you can't, again, well, this is really fun for me. I could talk about this forever, but the evolutionary biology of metabolism is that, you know, you are kind of parked at this place where, you know, evolutionarily you've been able to get that much energy in and you make the use of all of it out. And maybe that's in activity or maybe it's in reproduction. Ultimately, evolution cares about reproduction. But wherever you get parked, that's kind of where it's hard to move from that. You know, lifestyle doesn't have a big effect on where you are relative to where you get parked by evolution. And we often think like, well, if you burn more calories, then you ought to be less fat. But actually, we're also more fat because we got parked at a high place. We're parked at a high metabolic rate. So we need that extra gas tank to kind of help us, you know, get through any lean times.
Is it possible that in 150,000 years of our sorry-ass modern lifestyle, we're going to evolve to burn fewer calories or something?
I think that's possible. Now, the way that that's going to happen is not going to make anybody happy. Because the way that evolution happens is the people who don't fit as well are sick and don't have kids. You know, they're unhealthy and for whatever reason or not successful in terms of reproduction, and they don't have kids. And so, or their kids don't do well. That's the other thing that can happen. So, you know, there's not going to be, it won't be a happy story of evolution. It never is.
Well, actually, if we've mitigated a lot of that, we can still tee up a sickly 18-year-old to reproduce. So maybe we don't have that potential to evolve ever again because we're so smart that we neutralized evolutionary forces, selection pressures.
Yeah, you could spin it different ways. I can tell you that it's unlikely that, I mean, first of all, kind of any sort of, you know, governmental planning for who should reproduce, that we know that that's a terrible idea. we know that that's ugly and eugenics and gets really bad really fast. So sort of trying to make that happen would be really dangerous. But even letting it happen or hoping medicine kind of smooths out the edges of it, I don't know. I think it's a tough ride. I think the better idea is to try to pull the, you know, what we know keeps us healthy because it's how we kind of evolved to be healthy. Get those principles back into our lives. I think that's a faster way to get there. Yeah, more humane way to get there.
Kind of reverse it. Well, we're on a bell curve. We want to go back to our human roots. Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Okay. So back to this calorie idea, and isolating as Homo sapiens is helpful. And then, when we're looking at the constrained daily energy burning, first we throw in the brain, which burns what, 20% of our total daily calories?
20% of our resting calories anyhow. Yeah. I guess it depends on, to think about exactly the number there, but yeah, it's about 20% of our resting, I think, because it's 300 calories a day. Yeah. And you burn about 1500 calories at rest. So yep, about 20% of resting calories are for your brain, which means every fifth breath you take is the oxygen for your brain.
That Sting could rename his song, "Every Fifth Breath You Take." Yeah.
I love it.
Now, I think you mentioned this already, but the variation in brain caloric expenditure is minimal, whether you're sitting on the beach staring at the flat scenery or engrossed in an 8-hour exam for your doctorate level studies.
Yeah. As far as we know, thinking as hard as you can think, that doesn't move the dial very much. Maybe about 4 calories an hour, I think, is the best. 4 kilocalories an hour, I should say, is the best measure so far.
So if you have a good knife, you cut the M&M in half, right? Isn't the M&M your go-to reference point?
Yeah, I love it because everybody's had M&Ms, you know? So one M&M is about 4 kilocalories.
Yeah. Oh, okay. One M&M. Okay.
Yeah.
That puts the bowl that's been demoed to shame on the desk in our busy day in the office. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, what about the other organs in a resting state? There's some good research to certify that, the muscles are burning energy during exercise, but they're burning a huge amount of our daily calorie pie at rest too.
Yeah, a fair amount, just because there's so much of them. Pound for pound, your muscles are not as quiet as fat, definitely, but not quite as expensive as other organs. So your big costly organs are your brain, like we said, which, you know, basically runs a 5K every day, right? 300 calories a day. Your liver, which is about the same, actually, your liver does about that much work. Oh. Your intestinal, your gut, your GI tract, particularly after you've eaten, all those, you know, the cells of your GI tract are busy getting the enzymes, you know, and cutting up all that stuff and getting it transported, actively transported through the intestinal wall. Kidneys are really active. Your heart's a muscle, so it isn't special, you know, compared to other muscles, but it's contracting all the time rhythmically, right? Mm. So it ends up, it adds up to a lot of energy. So those are the big ones: liver, heart, brain, and kidneys and GI tract.
Muscles at rest.
Yep.
Kidneys. So we're filling in this pie, whether we exercised or not, which I think is the takeaway I want the listeners to really embrace. Right. And then if we, as distinguished from our next door neighbor, go out there and actually do run a 5K, maybe you can walk us through what happens to that big number at the end of the at the end of the calculation.
Yeah. So the way that we usually think about energy expenditure is we do the math like you and I have been doing. We add up all our organ costs, and then we have the energy cost we know it is to run a mile or run a 5K. We add that to it, and we think, okay, we just add all those up, and it's like a grocery bill at the end of the day. Those are our kilocalories per day. And that's how any online calculator for your energy expenditure works, for example. But we know it's more complicated than that, because actually the numbers that we're talking about with things like your liver and actually whole systems that we haven't talked about, like your immune system, your stress reactivity system, reproductive system, other aspects of your body, they follow a really strong circadian rhythm, and they respond to stresses throughout the day. And so what you think of as sort of your organs' energy expenditure or your organ system's energy expenditure, you know, we can give these numbers like 300 calories a day for your brain or 300 calories a day for your liver, but that's like kind of at baseline. Now, your brain doesn't go up and down very much, that's true, but the rest of your organ systems do. And particularly, you know, you have a circadian rhythm to everything, right? Testosterone level starts off high in the morning, by evening is much lower, for example, right? Okay, so what happens is if you take that 5K run, and especially if you start doing that repeatedly, so your body gets used to that level of workload, you will adjust, what seems to be happening, it adjusts the other expenditure and other systems to make room for that higher level of running, right? So day to day, you might go up and down, right? Because if you run a marathon tomorrow, but you didn't today, then you burn more calories tomorrow than you did today. Fine. So it's not like your body is making these adjustments on the fly second by second. That's not happening. But the overall circadian rhythm and background energy expenditure that your body is used to doing, as well as stress reactivity, for example, your reaction to stressful stimuli, those do get modulated by physical activity. If I'm more physically active, my circadian rhythm kind of gets damped down to make room for that activity. My stress reactivity to stressful stimuli gets damped down. My cortisol levels go up less. My epinephrine goes up less. My, you know, adrenaline gets less. And all of those things seem to be saving energy so that, you know, in my a sedentary person or the person who's running that 5K every couple of days end up having the same total energy expenditure per day. I might have gone through that a little bit too fast or too much, but that's the idea.
Right. So the person running around the office in a hectic, frenzied state that didn't do the 6 a.m. spinning class. Mm. And then the chill person, the athletic person in the office who's just breezing down the hall to get another pack of Post-it notes and then breezing right back to their desk. The frenzied person is catching up to the spinning class that they blew off because they slept in.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to think about it. The other way to think about it is, you know, you've got two people in the boardroom, right? And they both get up to say what they have to say, to give their report, you know? And that's a great example of what we'd call a Trier social stress test. Public speaking always gets people's heart rate up. Mm. And even if you feel really cool about it and calm about it, your body still does a little bit of that fight and flight response. This has been measured in lots of studies. Heart rate goes up because your adrenaline's going up. cortisol levels go up, right? Both of those reactions cost you energy. Now, there's two people in the boardroom, one who exercises all the time, one who is much more sedentary. The person who exercises all the time, her response is going to be blunted. Cortisol level is not going to go up so much. Adrenaline level is not going to go up so much. And they're both going to recover back to baseline faster. The person who gave that report and doesn't exercise all the time is going to feel a bigger burst. It's going to experience a bigger burst of cortisol, a bigger burst of adrenaline, and it's going to take longer for them to come back down to baseline because their body isn't used to spending its energy on activity. And so isn't sort of making that room, damping down those reactions compared to the person who is exercising all the time and their body has damped those reactions down.
I guess that would be on the list of benefits to getting regular exercise.
Absolutely.
Assuming it's conducted properly, because I don't want to be that guy that I have been that overtrains to the extreme and everything's damped down to where I don't feel like my famous example was I lived 0.6 miles from the mailbox for a while and I drove there every single day because I was too tired from my 84-mile bike ride to pedal another 0.6. Oh, and then back is 1.2. You know, it was just ridiculous. But so if a properly conducted exercise program is in place there, you're a more chill person and you don't abuse the stress response.
Mm-hmm. Same thing. And the same thing for the immune system, right? Mm. That person who is, you know, regularly exercises, so their body has adjusted to that level of exercise regularly in their life, their background inflammation level is going to be lower too. Okay. And what's your immune? Chronic inflammation is your immune system run amok. It's your immune system on all the time, right? When it doesn't have to be. So like we all want a fire department, right? We all want to be able to call 911 and the fire department comes and saves our home. We don't want the fire department to be parked in our driveway every morning, spraying down the house for no reason, right? That's background inflammation. That's that chronic inflammation is the fire department never goes home. The person who's exercising regularly, they don't have that problem, that inflammation at a high level all the time. The person in the boardroom in this scenario that doesn't exercise, is really sedentary, their inflammation levels are going to be higher. And we know this, we've known this for a long time. And I think what the constrained energy idea says is, this is why. This is your body managing how it spends its energy. And so it kind of gives a coherent framework to all these individual observations that we've seen over the years of doing research on people who exercise versus don't, the benefits of exercise. A constrained energy model kind of helps put those all together into a coherent, oh, this is why, this is how.
So we know there's all these different triggers for chronic inflammation, adverse lifestyle practices, but I'm not clear that is it also lack of exercise can promote chronic inflammation?
Yeah. So we know that people who exercise a lot have lower, and not over-exercise, we're not talking about, you know, people who exercise regularly and responsibly, I guess, have lower levels of inflammation than people who don't, all other things, you know, equal. Other people's labs have shown this. My lab is in the middle of an analysis showing this, looking at the NHANES data set in the US. This is a well-known thing. The inflammation is one of lower inflammation is one of the big benefits of exercise. And there's other things you can do too that will help you, you know, minimize inflammation, but exercise is a big one.
Right. I mean, on the checklist, we have get enough sleep, eat the right foods, get rid of the junk foods, don't over-exercise. And now adding to the list, don't under-exercise, don't sit around all day.
Right. Right. Don't pollute yourself, you know, don't smoke.
Right. So is that just due to the genetic disconnect when you compare, contrast the Hadza who are always on the move and doing all these wonderful things for their body versus we're not really designed to sit in a chair for 8 hours?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that the Hadza are so darn healthy. You know, no heart disease, no diabetes. And it's because, you know, they don't have these cardiometabolic risk factors that we do. They're getting their exercise every day. It doesn't hurt that they're outside all the time. You know, I think we can also focus on the fact that they've got family connections, friendship connections that they have their whole lives. They're not, you know, they don't have the kind of psychosocial stresses that we have as much. They have their own set of stresses, but they're not the kind of, you know, the ones that we face so much, loneliness, disconnection, inequality that we have in the States, for example.
So we hear all about the importance of that cardio, low-level cardio, moving around, getting up from your desk and moving. Do you see the Hadza doing any explosive activity for any reason? I can't imagine there'd be an artificial reason like a sprint race on the fourth week of the sunny, rainy month. But is there any need? You know, we're romanticizing the primal paleo thing where we had to run away from the saber-toothed tiger. And so sprinting is really great for the human to build up those muscles and burst the adaptive hormones. Right. But down in Africa, what do those guys have going?
Well, so, the Hadza don't run from predators. The predators run from them. The Hadza can kick a pride of lions off of a kill. You know, we've been in camps where they've done that. So they're kind of the top predators there. Now, of course, a single guy or woman out there can get surprised or whatever by a predator. Sure. I mean, that can happen. And in those rare cases, maybe once in a lifetime, then they would run. Of course they would.
It's not happening all the time. They'd probably get eaten too. They're not going to.
There's a good chance of that. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wonder where this romanticizing came from, that humans should be out there doing these amazing CrossFit accomplishments in the name of health. I mean, not to, I'm obsessed with high jumping because it improves my life and I love it. And I feel like it's delaying the aging process, but it may be not honoring my ancestors like we think.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that they do stuff that requires real strength as well. You know, men climb up into trees to get wild honey or chop into tree limbs. I mean, that's hard work. Mm-hmm. It's not like powerlifting kind of work, but it's hard. You know, it's body weight kind of stuff. Digging for tubers in rocky ground, that's hard work. Mm. But explosive kind of, I don't see it with them. You know, and it's not just the Hadza, I should say. That I've got good colleagues who work with groups in South America. We have another project going on right now in northern Kenya with a group called the Dasnich, which are a pastoralist group. You know, I'm my friend and colleague network is full of people who work with small scale societies all over the globe. And the running from the tiger thing doesn't really come up, you know, because humans are kind of become the dominant player on the landscape kind of immediately upon becoming part of that landscape. You know, that I don't know where that ran. I would just chalk that up to the list of many romanticized things about the past that turn out not to really be true.
Right. So if we drafted the best primitive living hunter-gatherer and took them into the high school varsity track meet, they'd get crushed at anything from 100 to a mile, probably.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I think they would also wonder what the hell we are bothering to do. But, you get good at what you train at, you know, and nobody would be able to beat them in archery or, the tasks that they do. Mm-hmm. Nobody could outwalk them. Unless if you don't train for that stuff, of course, you're not going to be very good at it.
Yeah. So I guess we're just having fun and kind of advancing the sophisticated, just like someone who's painting a painting. There's no need for that in a way, but same with the extreme fitness endeavors. It's just kind of advanced life and the ability to do something that's rewarding in certain ways.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I love rock climbing and mountaineering, for example. There are very good reasons not to do those things. For example, gravity. Gravity is a great reason not to go rock climbing. But I love it, and I've given that some thought, like, why do I love this thing that clearly was not. It's not adaptive in any obvious way. But one of the side effects of having these big, crazy brains is this life of the mind and this feeling that life is more than just the pragmatic day-to-day stuff. And it's, and that we all live for that kind of experience that gets us feeling alive and gets us connected. And if that is running, intervals down at the track, then awesome, go do it, And if that's, doing a Iron Man, then do it, listen to your body. If you're feeling off, then okay, then maybe back off. But like, those are all great things. Just like you say, painting a picture or playing the piano. I mean, yeah.
It's a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece. Hey, this is going to be one of my favorite commercials because I get to introduce you to the delicious, nutritious, life-changing Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece. This is a mind-blowing nut butter blend that will soon ascend to your number one go-to snack, treat, or accoutrement for anything from dark chocolate, a cucumber celery smear, or mixed in with yogurt, oatmeal, cheesecake, or with a spoon right into your mouth, heading south. Let me tell you what I created in my kitchen through whirlwind experimentation and extreme sampling to my VIP product testing crew across the nation so far with 100% approval. In this beautiful jar, we have macadamia nuts, walnuts, cashews, the rare and precious coconut butter, coconut flakes, cacao nibs, real ancient sea salt, and organic MCT oil. Every single ingredient has been sourced to origin to be the very best we could find from around the world for the absolute highest purity and nutritional value. We run this product in small batches with a boutique family business in the Pacific Northwest, and everything is cold-pressed to preserve nutritional value. So if you like eating healthy, it's a dream come true for all those who are keto, primal, paleo, and vegan, vegetarian too. I come in peace, my global healthy living friends. Masterpiece, that is. Try some now, and it will change your life. I promise. If you don't like it, send it back to me. I'll eat it. You can order Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece on Amazon. Simple, simple. Or if you're bold, daring, and adventurous, buy three and get a bottle free at bradventures.com. Buy six and we'll send you 8. Christmas shopping early instead of late at bradventures.com. Check it out, Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece.
Okay, so now let me put you on the spot. All of the future of the human race is all in your hands. And it's a longevity contest. Mm. So you're going to have to leave your academic career. We're going to pay you $1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 what would you put into place? Would you become the CrossFit Games regional champion, or would you just walk more and whatever else would be thrown in there? Would you sleep 14 hours a day instead of 8, or from your research? Right. And just a fun question here. No pressure, man.
Yeah. And if I win, if I live the longest, is that the deal?
Well, the future of humanity is, depending on you getting to, let's say, 110, because now you can put all the resources you need. You can enlist any experts on your team.
Right.
And here we go.
Well, I've never been asked that question before. So you win a prize for that. Congratulations. Here's my answer, I guess, on the spot. I am on the spot. I think I model the Hadza in a way, but I don't cosplay as a hunter-gatherer, right? I get to keep my clothes and my climate-controlled house. But here's what I put into my life that I'm probably not doing enough of right now. I make sure that I'm active every day, and that I'm active for a couple hours every day at least, maybe more. And I do as much of that as I can outside. I try to make sure that I'm connected to friends and family in a way that's meaningful, right? So I don't get isolated and sad, because that will not be good for me either. And I eat foods that I buy in the produce and the meats section of my supermarket. I stay away from anything processed. I would probably still eat pasta and bread, but I stay away from anything that comes in a packet with a ready-made sauce. You know what I mean? And any of the snack stuff. And I grimace and cut out beer and the occasional sugary beverage too. Gosh,
that's what about your mental health, tough. Man? The popping open a beer after a tough 3-hour workday, because you'd go back from 8 hours to 3 hours.
That's right. Well, maybe I keep the occasional beer. Can I do that? We'll see. And then I start getting myself genotyped intensively to figure out how I can CRISPR in all the good the good genes, because we know that longevity is also quite heritable, right? So your likelihood of living to 100 is like 5 times or 10 times higher if you have a relative who's lived to 100.
Really?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. What's that?
If you stop on that one for a second,
yeah,
and you have maybe not the best genes for longevity, but you turn your lifestyle practices in a different direction than all of your ancestors who succumbed to white flour and sugar that came in the industrial age. Couldn't you transcend that? Or is there something in the genes that's beyond lifestyle practices?
So, okay, let's unpack this a little bit. Let's talk about when we think about nature versus nurture for any trait, okay? Nobody would be surprised to learn that, however tall your parents grew, with the height of your parents is pretty predictive of your height, right? Also, nobody would be surprised to learn that your nutritional environment growing up also affects your height, right? And whether or not you got sick as a kid, and other social stress can even stunt kids' growth. And so we understand height really well and kind of intuitively as this interaction between our genes and our environments. And we know that we kind of can't pull them. No kid grows up without an environment. And so you kind of can't pull those things apart super easily for any one individual, but we know that they're both at play all the time. If I want a kid to reach his full height potential, then I can feed him super well and make sure he doesn't get sick and I can do all the right things. But I still can't make somebody whose parents are both 5'0", 7 feet tall. That's really unlikely, right? And vice versa. I can't make a really tall person who's inherently going to be tall. It's hard for me to make that person very short. For all the evidence points to longevity being the same kind of thing, that we do have variability in the genetics that seem to dictate how long we last. We're all, in the same way that humans are all sort of between 5 and 6.5 feet tall, more or less, right? Yeah. I mean, that seems like a broad range to us, but nobody's as tall as a giraffe and nobody's as small as a mouse, right? There's a human range of heights. There's a human range of age spans that we can hope to get to if we stay healthy. Nobody's going to live to be 200, as far as we can tell. Nobody, people don't tend to fall apart at 30, right? We tend to fall apart in our older ages, what we call older ages. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's, we can and should do everything we can to improve our environments. But if to ignore a genetic background would be like ignoring the genetics of height. Of course, some people are going to be taller than others. Right? I don't know. So that's how I would answer that question. And I don't know that we know enough about the genetics of it yet to do anything about it. Right? It's one thing to say it's heritable. It runs in families. We can find these genes that seem to be related. It's another thing to say, now I'm going to manipulate that gene and fix it. That's a much harder thing to do.
So you'd go in for some appointments to see if they could manipulate your genes. But so far your list, it's not too troubling. You're going to get outside and be active for a couple hours a day. You're going to be connected with friends and family. So you're probably not even going to move from your existing house and your Saturday soccer game schedule. And you're going to eat the clean, wholesome foods from the grocery store. Mm-hmm. What else we have on this list?
That's it, man. Then we give it a ride. See how it goes.
Right. And then form the intention that everyone's counting on you. And so you're going to come through for us.
That's right. You speak it into existence. I'm going to live to be 110.
Right. Well, I'm firmly believe that's a big part of it. And I'm my goal is 123 because the current record's 122, Jean Calment. Right. And so it's easy as 1, 2, 3. Just believe it for,
Yeah.
Maybe I'll have a party when I'm 61 and a half, right? That's my midlife point.
Halfway there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So Herman's got it dialed, people. It's easy. We can all sign up for the plan now. We can all go to 110, whatever.
Sure. Let's do it.
Wait, let's see how much does that cost? Outside outdoor activity in the sun. So far, nothing there. Family and friends might have to pop for some plane tickets if your kids go off to college someday. And then meat and produce.
There you go.
There's Butcher Box discounts right now for listening to the show. I mean, this is easy.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is my coming back at you with a tough question from the audience at the conference. Here's the athlete. Athlete goes and trains harder and gets leaner and kicks butt and meets goals. Mm-hmm. And how does that layer into this constrained model of calorie burning when there seems to be this anecdotal evidence that if I can up my mileage from 150 to 300 on the bike, my quads are going to be bursting out of my legs. There's veins everywhere and I got a six pack.
Yeah, totally. So a couple of things there. One is, if you do resistance exercise or even a lot of hard endurance exercise like cycling, your muscles are going to respond and hypertrophy. You're going to grow muscle mass. Sure. That's fine. And when you're on a block, you know, when you're in your training mode and maybe you've had a bit of a rest season and now you're going to hit it and you're just going to crush it for a while and your body hasn't made that adjustment yet, or maybe you're even above where your body could possibly adjust, because you can push it up above that ceiling for a while. You'll come back down eventually, but you can push it up there for a while. So the Tour de France does that to you, for example, right?
So they're above the ceiling for a while. They're burning. Yeah. They test them. They're burning 7,000 calories a day or whatever they're burning. That's insane. Yeah. But then what happens when they come back down?
Yeah, your body is going to make you balance that out with a rest period. And either that's because you'll take a rest period because you're being smart.
Or one will be taken for you. Yes, yeah. People, one will be taken for you. I'm very familiar with that concept.
Yeah. I was talking to a guy in the UK who is a sports scientist for a couple of cycling teams that have raced the Tour de France, raced the series, the Tour and the Giro and the Vuelta. And those, you know, he says those guys, they can race one, you know, you probably know this as well if you're at all a fan, but those guys can really push and really race one race. And then the rest of it, the whole of the season, they are not, you know, they're not going to be competitive. They're not going to even really try to be competitive. You know, they'll be part of the crew and they'll help the other guys out. Right. But you can't do that to your body and max out for a month and then even take like the month off that they have and then do it again. It just doesn't work that way. And you have to have they have a whole off season too, from like October through, what is it, March? Maybe people listening probably know better than I do. And I don't know how much of that is just purely off and how much of that is just low level. But you have to have that because your body, you know, if you think about averaging this out over the course of a year, the energy expenditure has to stay kind of near that ceiling that everybody's behind underneath, because we're all humans. That is the kind of the ceiling, you know?
So we can maybe better understand this with expanding the timeline a bit.
Yeah.
Outside of a day, and every single day this is happening, but maybe it's if we look at our week or our month, and that's the part where I think we can all relate. When you go out there and have a big 8-hour hike to the top of the mountain, the next day is usually featuring a lot of couch time.
Yeah, that's right. Or if you push it for a week, then you take, you know, you're gonna, your body will find that balance, you know. Used to be this old expression growing up. I grew up in rural Pennsylvania and a lot of like DIY construction and that kind of stuff. And people would always say when they're putting in plumbing systems that, you know, or irrigation systems or anything like that, the water always finds its own level, right? That you kind of water will always even itself out across a big complex system. And I think energy expenditure kind of ends up being that way too. It takes a while to adjust, but your body will find its own level.
And it's possible that the increased devotion to fitness and quote unquote calorie burning at the workout has a beneficial effect on your calorie consumption. In other words, the six pack is coming out because the training is also affecting my dietary habits.
Yeah. I mean, that's a guess. It would be case by case. But yeah, I think that when people are doing, you know, what I'm going to really focus on my fitness and, you know, for this month, usually that includes thinking about your diet too, for most of us, I think. And so, you know, if your body's, again, if you think about what your body's used to and what it has adjusted to, if your body is used to being sedentary and you start exercising, it's going to take a while for your body to adjust, but then that becomes the new normal and you adjust. At some point you're going up too high to be able to adjust anymore. That's true. Like the Tour de France is not something you can adjust to and do forever and ever and ever. You can't. But, you know, that person who is exercising all the time and then they push it for that month to prepare for the Tour de France or whatever it is, their body is kind of going to try to adjust to that. Maybe they'll be up above where they can adjust to, in which case they will have to take a rest period and come back down to that level that your body is able to adjust to. But yeah, I think that's how you have to think about the longer time frames. I think that's right.
Could that include eating more calories in conjunction with training more? And everything's adjusting upward for a temporary period of time, I guess. You're not getting fat and you're not dropping a bunch of weight, but you're eating a ton. I brought up my son in my email exchange because, like, okay, look, this guy wakes up in the morning and all he does is eat and then it finishes the meal and then does a workout and then starts the next meal. And right. there's a lot of muscle mass that he's trying to support too. So maybe that's a two-part yeah. question, like the difference between someone who weighs 200 pounds, solid muscle, working out a lot versus someone who's sitting on 200 pounds.
Sure, sure. Well, if, I mean, every 200 pounds of muscle, every kilogram of muscle, of fat-free mass, I should say, that includes organ mass, but every kilogram of fat-free mass is 40 kilocalories a day, more or less. Of just, okay, you know, if you wanted to kind of track it that way. So when you, right. when you build 10 pounds of muscle, that's 5 kilos, let's say, then I would already expect that your energy expenditure just by your fat-free mass going up is going to go up. What, 5 kilos at 40 kilocalories a kilo is 200 calories a day, right? So you can squeeze a snack in there if you've gained 5 kilos of muscle.
A small snack, right. a handful yeah. of M&Ms. So the constrained model is constrained by body weight.
Yeah, it's a fat-free mass adjusted kind of way of thinking about things.
Oh, what about the fat?
So fat, you can throw fat in there too, and it doesn't really change the model. Fat doesn't really burn many calories. Fat's a tiny player. I mean, it's not nothing, and it makes hormones, it makes leptin and adiponectin and that kind of thing. So it's not like just dead weight, but in terms of calories per day, it really doesn't burn much.
Oh, so the 700 pound people that are on the TV show and in serious metabolic and health distress, are they consuming a massive amount of calories to support that 700 pounds or something?
Yeah. In fact, you know, people who are obese, people with obesity, not only have a lot of fat, but also carry a lot of muscle just to be able to stand up and walk.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. And so that's actually one of the big breakthrough observations in the 1980s. You know, the data wins. People were measuring energy expenditures in women with obesity and women without. This is the first study to do this. And to test what people had long thought to be the case, which is that if you have obesity, it's because you have a slow metabolic rate, right? And that seems to be so intuitive and seems like it had to be true. And they measure it. Nope, not true. Women, you know, body size, people with more body, people with more cells burn more calories. That's not a surprise, right? An elephant burns more calories every day than a mouse. Has to be true. Okay. So that happens within people too. If we look at if we took a big sample of people from tiny to big, the big people burn more calories than the small people. I mean, of course, right? And so we have to always sort of look at these things on a kind of as a function of how big you are. We have to correct for body size. So the obese folks who actually were, of course, they're bigger, were actually burning more calories than the slim people. But they're all on the same level when you consider the effective body size, right?
With a slight adjustment for body composition. So there's a 200-pound person.
So body size specifically, we're saying fat-free mass. So for fat, for a lean mass, for a given lean mass, they're burning the same number of calories. Yeah,
that's another deep breath section here. I mean, the obese person is messed up and their metabolic function is messed up. That's we've long understood. This reminds me of your answer on the email. The insulin-based view of obesity doesn't hold up to scrutiny. Can you talk more about that?
Oh, yeah. So the carbohydrate insulin model for obesity, this really beautiful idea.
elegant idea.
You know, we have this expression in, I think probably all fields of science say the same thing, but certainly as I was getting trained, it's a beautiful idea slain by an ugly fact. And I don't know who first said that.
Mark Twain or somebody.
And it's this idea that when you eat a meal, and particularly when you eat a high carbohydrate meal, and specifically a high simple carbohydrate meal, that your insulin spikes, right? Your body's response to that is a big bolus of insulin that you use, you know, your insulin levels go way up. And that much is definitely true. We can watch that happen in a lab easy. And then the next part is the mechanism that we think is important, which is that insulin, takes the blood glucose out of your blood. And in fact, as well as the fatty acids that are in your blood and parks them into your fat cells. That's what insulin does. It is a anabolic, hormone in the sense that it's taking molecules out of your blood and parking them away and building fat cells. And so then, and I'm simplifying here, but the idea then is that now your brain is sensing blood that is really low on blood glucose and fats, because you're in that insulin spike has packed them all away. So now you don't have them in your circulating anymore. And even though you've eaten this big meal, your brain senses that you have low fuel store, you know, mm-hmm. that the gas tank's empty. And so when your brain says the gas tank's empty, you get hungrier, you get tireder, right? Maybe, or you at least have a lower metabolic rate in response to that perceived starvation. And that's, of course, that becomes an ugly cycle, because now you're hungry again, now you eat again, now you, you know, sorry. So the idea is that insulin response, the carbohydrate insulin response, is responsible for obesity, because that's a kind of a runaway snowball towards obesity is this carbs, insulin, and now obesity mm-hmm. flow. It's all plausible. It's all a very possible set of things that could be true. And about 10 years ago, people were really excited about it. You know, I remember when the Hadza stuff came out and Gary Taubes emailed me about this, good calories, bad calories. And yes, we read the book, and I got excited about it too. I thought, oh, makes a lot of sense. I have to say, I didn't quite understand how you could square that with the sort of carbohydrate rich foods and meals and diets that people like the Hadza eat. but anyway, okay. Putting that aside for a moment, it seemed very plausible that it could work. And of course, there's so many stories of people, not just stories, but people's real lived experiences are, I cut carbs out of my diet and I did great. I lost so much weight and I'm so much healthier now. And everybody's so happy. I'm happy with that happens for people, right? Okay. But now we get to the boring part, which is let's actually test to see if that mechanism really works the way that we think it does. And so we can do controlled diet studies where we feed people a low fat diet or feed people a low carbohydrate diet, mm-hmm. right? And when you do that in a controlled way, mm-hmm. It doesn't work the way the carbohydrate insulin model predicts. You don't get the same insulin response to the low carb versus low fat diets that you expect. You don't get the same fat changes in fat, percentage in your body that you'd expect. There doesn't seem to be any magic to a low carb diet, other than the fact that if you cut carbs out of your diet, it's one way to reduce how many calories you eat. Right.
Same with cutting fat out, you're saying.
Yeah.
Right.
So we can assign people to a low carb diet. We can assign people to a low fat diet. And this has been done in lots of studies now. And it's been, you know, the response is similar. You know, you get people who lose weight on either diet. And, you know, the diet that you like, that works best for you, that feels the best for you, that's up to you. That's up to you and how you're wired and what your environment's like. But it's, you know, there's no magic to a low carb diet. And the carbohydrate insulin model specifically as a mechanism, every time it's been tested, as far as I'm aware, it's kind of come up pretty short.
Well, I guess backing into it, if you're hungry all the time, then your diet's not working well for you. So in that sense, if you're pumping a lot of insulin into your bloodstream, we know that to be unhealthy. That doesn't seem to be disputed. But it's sort of like you got to back into this story rather than get hit head first with this model, as it's called.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and there's different ways to stay full, and, you know, protein and fat make your body feel full for a lot of people. That works great. And so no kidding. You know, so if I have a low carb diet and my diet's full of healthy proteins and healthy fats, hey, I feel full on less. And, you know, and I've made the decision, humans, we have these big, wonderful brains that, you know, we have rules that we tell ourselves. And if the rule is I can't eat anything on that side of the menu, gosh, I just made it a whole lot easier to make sure I don't overeat.
Right. Right? Now I'm on the 16-8 plan. So there goes 16 hours of the day because my rule says I can't eat. I'm going to probably eat fewer calories. Not necessarily, though, because if I'm in the binge mode, because now I finally get to eat. We have to answer to Herman at the end of the day. It's going to be tough for us.
Yeah. The rules are, you know, what rules work for you are going to be a combination of, you know, how your reward system in your brain responds to sugars versus fats or whatever. And, you know, some people really love the structure of hard and fast rules. I love that this is what I eat. This is me. I do this. works great for them. Other people kind of chafe at that and don't do as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, this gets into the psychology of diet, and this is not my specialty. I'm an anthropologist, so I study a lot of human diversity and different, but not in a kind of prescriptive way. So what I can tell you as an observer of people across cultures is that people do different things differently. And there is usually not any one size fits all thing. Mm-hmm. Now, what size works for you? Well, talk to a dietitian or give it a try yourself.
So if we go into extreme diet mode, because we got to get that 10 pounds off before the bridesmaid gig.
Yeah, good luck.
What happens there?
Well, if you go too far too fast, right? Then again, we're evolved organisms. Our bodies don't like to lose weight. And you will, especially if you're, when you're feeling like you're starving, your body goes into starvation mode, cranks your metabolic rate down. Right, those same kind of tools that your body can use to adjust different organ systems and different metabolic systems, it can just turn them all down, and now you're in trouble. Right now, your metabolic rate's
you're
down.
Tired.
You're burning fewer calories than you were before.
Yeah. Okay,
and you know maybe you really were good about cutting a couple hundred calories of your diet out every day, but your body goes, yeah, well, you're also burning a couple hundred calories less now, unbeknownst to you, because I'm turning it down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then gosh, now I'm not losing any weight anymore. So it's really hard to do. I think you said, if I had, you know, cards on the table, the zillion dollar bet, how would I live forever? And that's a good question. Or well, to 110. What I thought you were going to say is cards on the table, how do you fix the obesity epidemic? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the answer I think is you start with kids. Because I think that once you get to be 40 and 50 and 60 years old, it's awfully hard to, all the data says you can change and you should try if you're at an unhealthy place in your life, but it's hard. It's just harder. You know, things get less flexible, less dynamic when you're older. Even your behaviors get less flexible. Right. And so I think you got to start with kids, because I think if you end up, you know, if you have a really serious health issue, weight issue, when you're in your 50s, it's harder to fix than if you can address that kid when he's 10 and fix it there.
Yeah, I guess if we're extremely out of line, which in many cases we are, with this ridiculous excess appetite and eating the highly palatable foods and until we're stuffed and have to undo our belt buckle, we can certainly make all these corrections. And then I guess maybe some, just like the athlete, maybe some recalibration will occur where you drop 10 pounds of fat successfully. And then when you want to go from 10 to 15, that's when you're saying these mechanisms are going to kick in and make it really tough.
Yeah. There's a really nice set of papers out recently by Kevin Hall and some other folks who've worked on weight loss for a long time. Looking at it's called the physiology of the weight loss state. Which is not eye catching maybe, but it was a fun conference I was at back in the before times when you could travel for conferences, and you know just how your body does recalibrate to a weight loss state and what we do about that and kind of move forward from that. I think that's going to be the next challenge, right? We've worked a lot on how do you lose 10% of your body weight if you need to do that. Now the next horizon I think for a lot of this is how do we keep it off. Or how do we get to the next 5%, or you know, that kind of thing. So the long-term stuff I think is going to be harder and harder not harder and harder necessarily, but it's going to be what's next. And just by nature of the fact that you're talking about long-term change, it's going to be harder to investigate because you're going to need long-term studies to do it. And so hopefully there's energy and funding and interest in that kind of stuff, because I do think that is the next phase.
What about like a fast one day a week where you're not going to go into survival mode.
Yeah.
And that's going to be you're going to try to drop some excess calories and then eat normally the other 6 days, or some type of, or alternatively, an under the radar approach where you consume 50 fewer calories than you burn, even though we have no way of knowing that.
Yeah.
It seems like that could be a path to fat reduction that would not fly in the face of your research and all that.
People have had good luck with intermittent fasting or different kinds of fasting approaches. And yeah, I absolutely, if that works for you, there's no reason it wouldn't. If you go too fast and too much, you're going to have that response, that reaction, that metabolic reaction. But if you can do it in a way that your body doesn't freak out, yeah, you could be okay.
Or I suppose going too fast too soon obviously would have that reaction, but I would imagine also eating 200 calories less per day for the next 5 years, you would probably compensate and burn fewer calories.
Yeah, eventually. I mean, the other thing is too, if you lose the weight, if you lose fat, you wouldn't expect to see too much of a change in the expenditure because fat's pretty quiet. But if you're losing, if any muscle goes along with that, then, you know, now your energy expenditure requirements go down too. It's tough. It's tough.
That's not going to sell a lot of quick fix weight loss programs, man. Yeah,
that's
maybe
why
you could call it It's Tough.
That's why I didn't write one.
It's tough. It's tough. Good luck. Here we go.
Yeah.
But finding the diet that works. I mean, that your tagline, find a diet that keeps you satisfied, that you enjoy, and it keeps you well fed, but is not an excessive amount of calories is a big winner there.
I think so. And I'm a big believer in human diversity I think it's a strength on all levels of diversity, of behavioral and physical and mental diversity. I think it's all good stuff. And why would we want to ignore that? Why wouldn't we want to embrace that when it comes to diet and everything too? Diversity is good and it's going to, some things are going to work better for some people than others. And I'm also a big believer that, there's a drive to be, we have a drive to be happy and a drive to be content, and we should honor that. And if you're doing things that make you just unhappy every day, miserable because of what you're eating or what you're trying to do at the gym, I mean, you're going to have a hard time keeping it up. And why should you? You know, find things that you enjoy doing. I think that there is a lot out there. As soon as we open up our mind and go, oh, I don't have to eat this particular way. Mm-hmm. I need to follow these principles. Well, now that seems pretty doable. I could find a way that will work within these principles. I don't have to exercise this way. I just need to get moving. Okay, I can find a way that gets me moving that I like, right? I think, I hope that that opens doors for people and is a way to kind of, if you have been frustrated, it is a way to kind of get back into it.
Right, and that would include like maybe not centering your life around meals because you're getting more healthy, you're moving more, you're getting good at burning fat, you're not pumping insulin into your blood all day and night.
Yeah.
And then you don't have, you forget about it and you're so busy, you work through lunch with nothing to show for it negatively.
Yeah.
Oh man, that was a great follow-up show. I'm getting clearer now. And I think that Tour de France example hits home where sure, of course you can get into your bridesmaid dress and then, we got to be reasonable and have those long-term sights too.
Yeah. Yep. That's right.
Okay, people, go buy the book Burn. It's going to blow your mind. It's a great work. I appreciate you so much, Herman. Thanks for joining us again. And good luck with everything you're doing. Keep it up.
Thanks, Brad. It was really fun to talk. Anytime.
Dun, 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 dun.
Thank you for listening to the show. I love sharing the experience with you and greatly appreciate your support. Please email podcast@bradventures.com with feedback, suggestions, and questions for the Q&A shows. Subscribe to our email list at bradkearns.com for a weekly blast about the published episodes and a wonderful bi-monthly newsletter edition with informative articles and practical tips for all aspects of healthy living. You can also download several awesome free ebooks when you subscribe to the email list. And if you could go to the trouble to leave a 5 or 5-star review with Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to the shows, that would be super incredibly awesome. It helps raise the profile of the BRAD podcast and attract new listeners. And did you know that you can share a show with a friend or loved one by just hitting a few buttons in your player and firing off a text message? My awesome podcast player called Overcast allows you to actually record a soundbite excerpt from the episode you're listening to and fire it off with a quick text message. Thank you so much for spreading the word. And remember, be rad.